Greetings, Starfighter. You have been recruited by the Star League to defend the frontier against Zura and the Kodan Armada. Are you ready? Prepare for blastoff.
I sit here waiting, contemplating what's the best day. Watching that movie, I believe the moment.
G'day folks, how you going? This is The Lethal Mullet, episode number 217 here on The Lethal Mullet Network, and of course live also on the Fandom Podcast Network for our good pals Kevin and Kyle over there beyond the pond in the United States. Tonight we're going to be looking at 1984's The Last Starfighter, directed by Nick Castle, starring Lance Guest, Catherine Mary Stewart, Norman Snow, and K.E. Cuter. And this is definitely one of the films influenced heavily by Star Wars and, of course, Tron and many others like it. I think this is, you know, well, actually more in the case of it came out in the same sort of time as Tron and was, you know, such a huge film for the time. You know, those early 80 brackets of 80 to 84 had some really monumental and beautiful films still to this day, like this one, which really holds up. And of course it had Robert Preston playing the role of Centauri in this, who's a lovable scoundrel. And obviously too, with that, we've got this great little universe which is ripe for a sequel, which we're going to talk a little bit about later on. There's been pitches and there's certain being Gary Witter involved in what seems to be something called The Last Starfighters, plural. So is that really the last, or is that just many last starfighters? Who knows? We're going to find out about that tonight here on the Lethal Mullet Podcast. So grab yourself a cup of joe, sit back, relax, grab your earpods, and listen to, of course, the greatness of the Mulleteer himself, the Lethal Mullet.
G'day, man. How you going? Welcome to the Lethal Mullet Network, where you'll find all these amazing shows and more. Where you'll find the Lethal Mullet Podcast, a celebration of action cinema from the 80s, 90s, and beyond. You'll also find Making Treks, a Star Trek fan podcast, where I'm joined by my amazing co-host Mark Newbold into a deep dive of Star Trek. You can also find Mullet and Kilt, a look at music, where I'm joined by my dear pal Darth Elvis, and where you can also find the Mullet Guild, a look at the Dune universe, all here on, of course, lethalmulletnetwork.podbean.com or on your favorite podcatcher. You can find us there. You can also find all these shows a week later on, of course, the one, the only Fandom Podcast Network, FPN, on fpnet.podbean.com. Don't forget to also follow us on socials. There's, of course, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at the handle at the Lethal Mullet. We'll catch you out there and enjoy your action cinema.
The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy has many a thing to say about Deep Thought. And Deep Thought itself has many a thing to say about the guide. But who are going to give you a guide through the maelstrom and enormity of the guide itself? Hosted by two unexpected travelers, the Lethal Mullet, all the way from Quinlan's Cantina in the Milky Way, and of course Dan the Man from Birmingham, all on the other side of the water, they have hitched a ride and come to Ursa Minor, tell you all about the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which you can find whenever you find good podcasts.
That's right, folks. Check out the brand new show, Deep Thought Life, Douglas Adams and Everything, monthly on, of course, the Lethal Mullet Network at lethalmulletnetwork.podbean.com or on the socials at The Lethal Mullet. You can also check it out on YouTube very soon on the Spacebook Network, hosted by the one and the only co-host here, Dan the Man from Birmingham, Dan Hadley, all here. And don't panic, we'll be back.
And now, it's time for the news here on the Lethal Mullet Podcast.
We're going to jump straight into something that I know all of you are going to be wanting to
hear about, and that is, of course, is there a Last Starfighter 2? And there's been many attempts, folks, a number of attempts to get this property back up and running and get it out there. And this is where it comes quite interesting, because since about 2018, Gary Witter has been involved in any iteration that's coming through as a screenwriter. And it's actually might even be before that. So it's been quite a while back. His interest has been in it for many years, which makes it interesting because he definitely wrote some of the best Star Wars we've seen since George left the company of Lucasfilm. That is, of course, Rogue One. Yes, definitely my favorite of the Disney Star Wars films, if you like. So let's have a look at it. So GPA Entertainment added a thing called Starfighter, which is the sequel to the classic motion picture, to many of its projects in 2008 in February. And basically, it was stuck in a pre-production phase, it says. It was still there in 2012, so that's about 4 years of just concept work. And Hollywood had been looking at people to both direct it and be involved in it. People like Seth Rogen and Steven Spielberg at one stage were involved, with screenwriter being Gary Witter. All in had an interest in the film itself. You got to think about it, it's a very Spielberg film, the first film. You know, it's got that whole E.T. thing going on, and putting it in a trailer park really just it set it apart from the others, because it wasn't just like an American town or something like that, which is for the majority of us living outside of America, when we see Hollywood films or films made in America, for us to be able to relate to them outside of, you know, what the cities in the United States look like, it's great to have something like a trailer park, or an house out here in Australia, it's a caravan park. So, yes, we're used to that. We know what those things are, and it made it more accessible, which was a very smart move by Nick Castle. So the rights for the film have been basically defined to conflicting information at the time. So Universal Pictures obviously owned a portion of it too. Some rights by Warner Brothers, and of course Lorimar Telepictures as well. And that's the newer version of Lorimar from back in the 80s. So who had the rights was the big real interest in it. Back in 2015, though, Jonathan Buettel wanted to write a TV reboot of the movie. Now, could you do that? Yeah, you certainly should be able to do that, especially now with all this, the streaming shows that we have now that are so prevalent in Star Wars and Marvel and all these other, like Star Trek, perfect example. That's doing great guns and doing even better than Disney's run of Star Wars. All right, so, really getting out there. 2018, Witter basically started putting concept art out of the Last Starfighter sequel on his Twitter. And basically, in the same time, he'd indicated that Buettel will be with him along with that one too. Obviously, too, they'd done a lot of concept artwork. By the time of 21, they did the reel. And that's basically where we're at, folks. We've got this concept of a film that could be, and it is called The Last Starfighters. Now, some of the concept art looks fantastic. There's a downed ship, a captured pilot, and then we go to Earth, and we have an alien assassin going back to Earth to try and take out whoever's there. Now, it doesn't take too many, points to point out that basically what the film would be about is a lost brother. I personally think that Alex gets captured, and he is, held for ransom by the Codan Armada and basically Lewis Rogan. So Alex Rogan's captured. Lewis, the brother, the now middle-aged brother, will have to come and find, of course, his brother. And I think that's a great thing. I mean, that's what I would do. And it's something that, would definitely fall in line with where you would go with a Last Starfighter story or pitch. I think that's a smart thing to do. It's definitely, the whole brother thing was a big part of that film, particularly when the beta unit was part of the story. So I think with that, it makes, an interesting idea of, going through the cycle of somebody learning to be a starfighter pilot again, or in this case, a gunner. Because that's really what he was. He wasn't really a starfighter pilot, was he, folks? No, he was a gunner. An artillery man. One that fires at the ships and, of course, does everything. And Death Blossom was, of course, the cure to many of their problems in this one too. I'm really interested to see where that would go, folks, but you have to have faith in Jonathan Buettel and, of course, Gary Whitta that this will come to pass. And hopefully we'll hear those words, "Greetings, Starfighter," again.
Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying this podcast. Here are the other great shows on the Fandom Podcast Network. Culture Clash, where we discuss the latest in entertainment and pop culture. Blood of Kings, our show covering the entire Highlander universe. Couch Potato Theater, we celebrate our favorite movies. And Time Warp, our fandom flashback show discussing a year in movies and our favorite retro movie, TV, and pop culture topics. Good Evening, discussing all things Alfred Hitchcock. Hair Metal Podcast, we cover the rock metal music of the 80s and early 90s. Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast, discussing the time-traveling Doctor Who universe. Lethal Mullet, an action film podcast, covering the 80s, 90s, and beyond. Also, check out the Lethal Mullet Network for more great podcasts. What a Piece of Junk, our Star Wars podcast. Making Treks, a Star Trek podcast, with a deep dive into the final frontier. The Fandom Show, our Fandom Podcast Network live YouTube show discussing the hottest topics in fandom. The True Believers MCU Podcast, discussing the Marvel Cinematic and Television Universe. Union Federation, our Star Trek and the Orville Show. And we're proud to welcome the BQN Network to the Fandom Podcast Network. Please visit our friends on the BQN Network, a Star Trek Universe podcast that also includes your favorite topics, movies, history, superheroes, and more. You can find the Fandom Podcast Network on YouTube. Fandom Podcast Network is also on all major podcast platforms. The Fandom Podcast Network audio master feed is on Podbean at fpnet.podbean.com. You can find the Fandom Podcast Network on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can email us at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening, and remember, respect others and enjoy your fandom.
Hey, how's your man?
Yeah!
Yeah! Yeah!
Welcome to the dojo. Leave your shoes outside the door.
All right, here we are in the dojo, folks. I'm about, I would say, 8 to 9 months away from going for my Shodan Ho in Jigao Karate. This is my third run through a full system of martial arts, and I'm really enjoying the journey. I think a lot of us are so focused these days on the end result of where we're going, but now that I get a chance to, you know, just enjoy the journey, I'm not in a hurry as such. And so this has been a 3-year journey for me, and it just started basically the height of COVID. When COVID was starting to come down, the dojos were opening again, and pretty much the only exercise I was doing at the time was not martial arts, it was gymnasium. Going to the gym and, you know, working out and doing the sauna, all that sort of stuff, doing swimming, you know, not really stuff you could do at the time because of COVID. But with martial arts, I could definitely get my cardio happening. And it's been a real journey of self-discovery, but also, yeah, fitness too, getting back on top of my weight and stuff like that too. But one of the great things about this is the crowd that you're around. You meet some really focused individuals that want to achieve results, but also it's a very positive bunch, because only people that are going to want to be going every day to do this, or every at least 4 times a week to train, are going to achieve that of a high grade, let alone a black belt, which is a lot of work. So I'm keen to really just enjoy the ride, folks, and get to where we need to. But it's also interesting having a background in different styles. A lot of what I've found within my martial arts system is, you know, folks that are pretty much directed to one style, which is karate, which is nothing wrong with that. You know, I think that's fantastic that they're dedicated to bettering themselves in that one system, you know, and that's, if that's all they want, that's a fantastic thing, and all the luck to them. But for me, I've had quite a varied background in martial arts, you know, a bit of grappling, a lot of weapon systems, but also, you know, a lot of different striking systems too. And it's interesting how that memory or that muscle memory builds up in your system, in your body. And, you know, it informs you as techniques come to you. A lot of that being, of course, you know, repeating movements so many times that it becomes second nature to who you are. So even at this grade, where basically we're not allowed to hold back because we're meant to be really seeing how, and that doesn't mean going full contact. That just means really showing that you understand the techniques, you know. And I think that's an interesting way of, too, also trying to not use other systems within your kumite, your sparring and stuff like that, too. So it's interesting because you leave that at the door. You're here to learn something completely new, but still creeps in, particularly with takedowns. With anyone that's done Daitoru, Aiki Jiu-Jitsu or something like that, you'll understand what I mean. When you get close quarter, your body takes over.
And I've been working long, long, long days ahead, working in front of a VHS. From 1980, from the 90s to the 2000s, there's some damn good films. From Arnold to Sly to Jean-Claude, we cover all of those flicks.
Alrighty, mate, time to go down to the pub for a pint, chat, action movies and more, here on the Lethal Mullet Podcast. All right, folks, here we go. We're going to be chatting about The Last Starfighter from 1984. A great film, which has got a hell of a cast with it, folks, as well. You know, the film came out July 13, 1984, directed by Nick Castle, and, of course, written by Jonathan R. Bittell, produced by Gary Adelson and Edward O. Deneau. This is a great one. Obviously, we've got a hell of a cast, which we're going to get into in a second here. One of those being, of course, Lance Guest, who, you know, obviously mainly known for this film, but also his stint on Jaws of Revenge. The best Jaws film, folks, because it is Jaws. Shark versus Michael Caine. That's right, his hoes. You know, I've always said that Michael Caine versus the shark is the best and most exciting film you're ever going to see this season. Yeah, and it is. It's amazing. Music by Craig Safin. It was an amazing score. And it really still is to this day. It rivals all the others, folks. It's got that real uplifting feel. I mean, imagine this soundtrack not being there, you know, and not having that lovely feel that it has. It goes for just a little over 90 minutes. It goes so quickly, but you could easily rewatch it straight away afterwards and get the same feel. It's fantastic. It had a budget of $15 million and did just under double, did $29 million just in North America alone, which is amazing, you know, and that's what I think about it so good. It's good because its use of, you know, effects and stuff like that is a big part of what the film does for, you know, obviously CGI, just like Tron did, I guess, back in the day. But let's get into it. Let's talk about the story and let's get a little bit of history on how this film came together. And it's an interesting story, just like the movie. So the movie starts with Alex Rogan, who's a teenager living in a caravan park. Of course, in Australia, we call that a caravan park. In the States, you call it a trailer park because you call them trailers over there. Fair go. So so he's living there with his mother and younger brother, Lewis, and basically he's there trying to get a scholarship to go to the city to become something, to get out of his, you know, little world or the little microcosm that he's in. And, of course, he's angry that he can't go anywhere and he's got a nowhere feel to his existence where he is. The only thing that he's got to do there is a game. It's a computer game, just like the Atari games at the time. And it is, of course, called Starfighter. And this is where, basically, the whole movie starts. It centers around this computer game. And the computer game is about a starfighter that has to go up against the Kodan Armada in a massive space battle defending the frontier against Zua, a rebellious man who comes from Rylos and who's broken away and working for the Kodan. So this whole thing is basically a ruse, of course. It is to get somebody that wants to be a starfighter to be picked up and taken away to basically become a real starfighter pilot. So it is Excalibur, as we get to find a little bit later. That's actually part of one of the gags that Grig says about, of course, Centauri, who is basically the Merlin in this, if you like, or the Obi-Wan Kenobi. Kind of a bit more Han Solo, but still the same. So Alex becomes the highest scoring player ever of the game, and all of a sudden he's visited by the game's inventor himself, Centauri, who says, right, I'm going to take you for a ride, and you're not going to believe where it's going to be. And this car turns up like it's something out of Back to the Future or Robocop or something like that, gets in the car, and he goes on his way to Rylos. While he's gone, somebody takes his place on the planet, and his name is Beta. And Beta is basically a doppelganger, an android to take the place of any of the pilots that they take. So Alex finds out the Starfighter itself is basically real. All the story in it is completely real. The Rylan Star League is being attacked by the Kodan Armada, this massive empire, and it's led by Zua, who's basically a native to the planet, but he's a traitor, and he's also the son of the ambassador of the Endurian. He's the Starfighter commander, and basically from here, the Kodan Empress trying to control Rylos. The only thing holding them back is the frontier. So, again, it's basically a recruiting tool for an empire, at war. And, of course, the ship that they fly is called the Gunstar. So the people that play these games are actually the gunners. So they're the people that are using, basically the weapon systems. While they're given a pilot, and this is where we meet, of course, Grig, played by Dan O'Hillahy. Of course, you'll know him probably more so for Robocop, actually. Robocop 1 and 2, he plays the old man who runs, of course, OCP. And for years, I had no idea who was in there. All I knew that he did that laugh, that got a laugh, because it's the only way he could get expression out of the mask. But, I mean, Dan O'Hillahy plays it with such a exuberance and warm charm and humor, a real natural sense of humor. And he's a great, not only mentor, but a friend to Alex. He becomes a real, true friend. And I think that shows, it's beyond... Well, it's beyond, worlds, this friendship. It's amazing. So from here, we basically get Alex saying that he doesn't want to be in the Star League. He just wants to go back home. But while they're there getting recruited, Zua turns up by hologram, facing his father in Durin. And from here, we get this, basically, if anything, it's exposition. We get a little bit of a background about how things are going. And it only makes Alex want to go home more so, because he's like, what the hell? And, of course, it's not just Earth that's being, run into this thing. So from here, we get to see Alex meet Centauri again, and Grig takes him down there and says, look, are you up to your old Excalibur tricks again there, Centauri? And says, Earth isn't even meant to be on the Star League's map until they've become more civilized. And, of course, from here, they are attacked by, of course, the Kodan Armada. All the ships are out in battle, and, of course, they all get destroyed. All but one Gunstar, an advanced prototype Gunstar, survives. So Alex goes back, discovers the Beta, and then from there contacts Centauri to take him back. Centauri gets there just in time as Alex and Beta are attacked by an alien assassin. And, of course, the alien assassin has a great name, a Zandozan. I love it. And a lot of these, the makeups in this are fantastic. They are very Star Wars-esque, less looking like a Star Trek thing. I think that they've definitely gone that
Mos Eisley Cantina sort of feel and look in this. And it really, it looks the part, folks. It's fantastic. And we'll get into who is actually under the mask in this very, very soon. You get to see the human face as well. There's some Star Trek people in this film, folks, along with Young Guns. So there you go. There's a couple of ideas there too. So from here, Centauri gets shot, unfortunately, and as we see, possibly dies. From here, we also jump to Grig training Alex, and Beta finds it difficult to maintain, basically from here on, his impersonation. Of course, this is along with a character we haven't talked about yet, which we should, which, of course, very central to the story, which is Maggie Gordon. Maggie, of course, is Alex's girlfriend, and everything that Alex has done, you know, he wants to still take part in obviously being in a relationship with Maggie, and of course, played amazingly by Catherine Mary Stewart, who to this day is still so passionate about this film, just like Lance is. And, you know, again, it's everything centers on, you know, at first in the film, their love life together. And, of course, you know, the interactions that she has then with Beta, and how Beta has no idea how to be, you know, obviously intimate with a partner and stuff like that. And, of course, the hijinks and many, many funny things ensue. If you've seen the film, you know exactly what I'm talking about. So from here, obviously more Xander coming down to attack, and of course Beta has to take up again as Grig trains Alex. Alex and Grig then go against the Kodam mothership after many skirmishes, cripples communications, and of course all of Alex's weapons are completely gone. They're depleted. This is where we're introduced to the final thing that this prototype Gunstar has, which is of course Death Blossom. And of course, once that's triggered, the thing goes into a massive spiral and, of course, takes out all the fighters. So from there, Alex is proclaimed the savior of Rylos. And, of course, from there, of course, they're going to rebuild the Star League until, of course, the frontier can be fully known. Of course, Zur escapes. And from here, we get to see, obviously, the return of Centauri, revealing himself that he's healed. And again, he was just in a healing stasis afterwards too. From here, Alex agrees to stay, but he must return to see Maggie and, of course, take Maggie with him back to, of course, Starfighter. From here, we get to see Lewis also being behind the reins of the game of Starfighter. Of course, that gives hints to where they always intended the story to go, is, of course, Lewis taking the reins of Starfighter. The film's had a very interesting cast and history. We'll go through a little bit of that now too. Obviously, Lance Guest, one of the big ones. I mean, Lance has always been somebody I've been interested in the work of. He's very active in the circles of fandom too. You get to see him at a lot of the conventions out there too. He basically very serious actor in his early days. Obviously, Last Starfighter, he's talked about on the behind the scenes how, you know, he went full almost method acting in that one too. We've got, of course, in Jaws of Revenge, Stepsister from Planet Weird in 2000, The Jenny Project, and, of course, Mark II. He's also been on TV in Knots Landing, Lou Grant, Saint Elsewhere, The Wonder Years, Party of Five, JAG, NYPD Blue, The X-Files, which I remember that one. It's good. Jericho, House, Life Goes On, and Becca. Here's a show you don't see anymore. They should bring that back on at least one of the channels. Becca was fantastic too. He's currently 62 years of age, and I've got to say, too, I love his positive nature when it comes to, yeah, being out there amongst the fans and giving it a chance for everyone out there, too. Centauri was played by, of course, the late, great Robert Preston, and what a fantastic actor, you know, and real entertainer. And so he was active, obviously, you know, through a massive career. After being in the military, he was in the U.S. Army Air Forces in World War II. So years of service was 42 to 45. He was a captain in the bombardment group. So he's a real, obviously, veteran as well. So thank you for your service, sir. Fantastic. And I must say, part of the charm of what Centauri is like is that he's that lovable, you know, scoundrel, that lovable rogue, you know, you really love. And I think too that it was coming from a musical that he'd done in 1962, The Music Man. And you know, he obviously has that charm, that wit, and that's that winning smile. You see that smile, you've almost, you know, this man is a good man. And what a fantastic, at the end of the day, you know, actor. He really obviously lives up the part and plays it so damn well, you know, that you want to be in, you know, obviously, without a doubt, you know, somebody that can be there and really learn from somebody with such an exuberance, if you like. It's that mentor figure that we always want in life, you know, that keeps the cool under pressure, all that sort of stuff. And I think that's what's key, is definitely having that. And that, you know, it doesn't always happen in life. So it's interesting. At the time, obviously, he was an actor and it was interrupted with, obviously, military service. But one of the great things is that he was a lead in a lot of B films at the time, but he was then also a villain as well. So he's played a wide variety of stuff over the years, and obviously westerns and all that sort of stuff. So what a fantastic actor, and you know, he's sorely missed. All right, let's go through some of the other actors here on the obviously Dan O'Hillahy, we've talked about Catherine Mary Stewart. Obviously, he's done a fantastic amount of work over the years, and again, I say that she's the heart and soul of this, and she plays it so well as, you know, somebody that's sort of overwhelmed by everything by the end of it, but obviously stands by Alex Rogan all the way through too. Fantastic. Norman Snow as Zua. Norman's done some work on Star Trek, so he's the first of the Star Trek actors that we're going to be talking about tonight. And Zua, you know, he's got the role of a rebellious son to a political figure. Yeah, quite interesting in it too. As the ambassador, and we have K.E. Cuda, who's quite fantastic in this. You know, I've seen him in some of the other work, and I think as the ambassador, he does a fantastic job of not only being ticked off that his son has taken off and joined the Kodan, but even more so. We've got Chris Hebert as Lewis Rogan. Again, you know, kid actor doing a fantastic job, I think, and particularly as Lewis. You know, he's, at the time, we were all that age when that movie came out, so it's interesting to sort of see that. We've got, as Lord Krill, Dan Mason. Vernon Washington as Otis. Again, great role. Otis is, again, somebody trying to let Alex know that just let things happen in life, you know, go with the flow, and I think, again, it all washes over the head of Alex. We've also got in here other names you may know. Peter Nelson as Jack Blake. We've got Peggy Pope as Elvira. We've also got Owen Bush as Mr. Boone. Mark Alimo as the Hitchhiker. There you go. Another of our many Star Trek alumni in this. And, of course, Mark was in DS9. We've got Will Wheaton, of course, as Lewis's friend. It's a very, very small part at the start. If you keep your eye out, you can see him. We've got also Jeffrey Blake from Young Guns. You know, again, the actor says here, I called him a fat sow. Obviously, he's the traitor that gets shot by Billy the Kid. And he plays Gary in this as well. So the production was shot in 38 days, mostly night shoots in Kenyan country. And it's interesting to see some of this great work out there. A lot of it, just brilliant stuff. And you know, what I love more than anything, I think, is, you know, the fact that a lot of the countryside in this is so much like parts of, you know, Australia to some extent, especially the outback, except you've got to take out the soil over here is so red. So we'd have red soil. But, you know, we have trailer parks, or in this case, caravan parks just like it. So it's an interesting location.
So definitely Spielbergian, but obviously taking it to a different location than Spielberg would do in suburban America. It's one of the first films that did, obviously, 3D proper computer graphics on film. Obviously, this was spearheaded by the designer, too, and who actually came up with the spaceships, the Gunstar, all that sort of stuff, which is a great designer, the amazing Ron Cobb, who'd done Star Wars, Conan the Barbarian, and Alien as well. Worked on those films too. And of course, it was all done by a company called Digital Productions. And they worked on a computer called the Cray supercomputer to put all this together. It was truly monumental. And again, some of the effects weren't done with animation. Some of that, of course, the beta unit. A lot of that stuff that was done there was practical effects done by a makeup artist by the name of Lance Anderson. And the Star Car was actually made by Gene Winfield. Now, if you remember, Gene Winfield was one of the creators of course, the Blade Runner spinners and many of the cars on that production too. Again, working his amazing work on that too, which I just think is fantastic too. Composer Craig Safin wanted to go for this massive sound, and it really is. In some ways, it seems Star Wars-esque, but even bigger, and I think that's what he was trying to do. As the composer said, he wanted to go bigger than Star Wars, and it certainly has more trumpet sounds to it and all that sort of stuff too. So this film seems to go pretty damn well with critics, you know, and stuff. It gets around 6 out of 10 or 7 out of 10, depending on the reviewers. But, I mean, it's still to this day, it is a fantastic, you know, one that I think is just really, really on the mark. So here's where it gets interesting. Obviously, there's been different spin-off ideas and things at the time. 84, we saw a tabletop gamer called the Last Starfighter, the Tunnel Chase, or of course, and this was done by Fasa, Fasa. But what they used to run was, for those that are into role playing games, was Shadowrun many, many years ago. So we got that. There was a book done by Alan Dean Foster who novelized the whole thing. Musical adaptation that was done by the Storm Theatre off Broadway in New York City, and that was done in 2004. There's also been comics. There was a Marvel Comics adaptation of it too. And there's been arcade game too by Atari. It was basically meant to come out. And I don't know if that ever – I never saw it in the place itself too. There were home versions of the game for the Atari 2600 and 5200 consoles. And that's definitely something that's, you know, hugely – popular at the time was the Atari machines too. But it's interesting. You look at it too, NES had a game and, you know, had the title Last Starfighter, but apparently it was a conversion of an older game from the Commodore 64, which is interesting too. So you could apparently get a freeware playable version of the game itself released for PC in 2007. And this is an actual, more faithful, as they say, reproduction of the arcade game from the film. It has the full sound effects and stuff. And the creators of this game, Rogue Synapse, have built a working arcade cabinet for it as well. So you've probably seen that around, folks. It's a pretty popular thing. So go and check out Rogue Synapse if you can. It's definitely out there. And, of course, we've already talked about the sequel, but one person who's definitely been in the mood for this sort of stuff is Ernest Cline, who, of course, wrote Ready Player One. He wrote a novel called Armada, which is very, very similar. Let's just hope there's a sequel, folks, because I can tell you I'm a huge fan of this property, and he gets a 5 out of 5 on the Hallenbach Scale.
Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying this podcast. Here are the other great shows on the Fandom Podcast Network. Culture Clash, where we discuss the latest in entertainment and pop culture. Blood of Kings, our show covering the entire Highlander universe. Couch Potato Theater, we celebrate our favorite movies. And Time Warp, our fandom flashback show discussing a year in movies and our favorite retro movie, TV, and pop culture topics. Good Evening, discussing all things Alfred Hitchcock. Hair Metal Podcast, we cover the rock metal music of the 80s and early 90s. Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast, discussing the time-traveling Doctor Who universe. Lethal Mullet, an action film podcast, covering the 80s, 90s, and beyond. Also, check out the Lethal Mullet Network for more great podcasts. What a Piece of Junk, our Star Wars podcast. Making Treks, a Star Trek podcast, with a deep dive into the final frontier. The Fandom Show, our Fandom Podcast Network live YouTube show discussing the hottest topics in fandom. The True Believers MCU Podcast, discussing the Marvel Cinematic and Television Universe. Union Federation, our Star Trek and the Orville show. And we're proud to welcome the BQN Network to the Fandom Podcast Network. Please visit our friends on the BQN Network, a Star Trek Universe podcast that also includes your favorite topics, movies, history, superheroes, and more. You can find the Fandom Podcast Network on YouTube. The The Fandom Podcast Network is also on all major podcast platforms. The Fandom Podcast Network audio master feed is on Podbean at fpnet.podbean.com. You can find the Fandom Podcast Network on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can email us at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening, and remember, respect others and enjoy your fandom.